I'm a soldier for Christ. I'm a soldier for Christ. I'm a
soldier. No, they'll never take us under, because we're bringing truth like thunder. Raining on your speakers like a ton of bricks. Hold the cross high, cause we're Catholics. Fight the good fight with the truth, stand tall with the truth. I'm a warrior for Christ, I'm in love with the truth. Love God, save souls, slay error.
Go stronger.
Holy Hour of Power, the Terry and Jesse Show, High Energy Catholic Radio. The month of February, which we just started, is devoted to the passion of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.
Amen.
The Catholic Church is our mother, and every single month the Church has a different emphasis. So this month, consider doing a Stations of the Cross, you know? Or here's what I'm going to do, personally. All month, the only mysteries of the rosary I'm going to do is the sorrowful mystery all month. And that way I can focus on the passion of Christ. There's another beautiful tradition. It's called the seven sorrows of Mary rosary, or the Dolorosary. Maybe you could say, hey, in February, I'm going to do just the Dolorosary for the entire month. It's very interesting. Many exorcists actually teach this, that if you want to know your personal defects, your vices, or the vices, the generational spirits that are affecting your family, do a 9-day rosary novena to Our Lady of Sorrows or the Dolorosary, and 9 days, and ask Our Lady, what defects and vices do I have and do we have in our family so that we can heal them with prayer and the sacraments. Terry?
Yes, you know, the saints have told us meditating on the Passion of Christ does more good for the soul than going around to visiting the Holy Land even and making a visit there. That's how powerful it is. Today's show, Jess, put your seatbelt on. We're not only going to talk about President Trump's saying that he's not going to leave the Republican Party. I'm hoping that what he does is he starts another internet so that people like us won't get cut out. That's what I'm hoping he does. Also, we're going to be talking about a former OMB director to set up a pro-Trump think tank. That's interesting to keep it alive. But most importantly, we're going to be interviewing Dr. Alan Moy. Months and months ago, almost a year ago when this COVID-19 took place, we had him on, and he was ahead of the curve back then, and I think he's going to be ahead of the curve right now from the, well, I call it Saint, but St. John Paul II Medical Institute on the COVID-19 vaccines and the pandemic. That's going to be interesting. But before we do any of that, what do? We go through soul food, the gospel, Jess, for the day. That's what we do. And Jess, I can't believe it, but almost every day you read something about demonic activity, and I never hear, well, very rarely, but I heard it today from Father Steve talking about exorcisms in the Bible. He talked about that. So I would like to ask you. Oh, there's the good doctor. I just see him here. Dr. Alan Moy, I see you on our screen. Welcome, my friend. Great to have him. Jess, go ahead and read your gospel to us for soul food.
I'm going to do this first reading because it's...
You're going to do Hebrews.
Yeah, it's very practical for the people right now.
It is. They're
fighting depression, anxiety.
That's true.
I think this is one for everybody right now. We need to hear this.
Okay, let's do it.
Speak, Lord, your servants are listening. Hebrews chapter 11, 32 to 40. It says, brothers and sisters, what more shall I say? I have not time to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who by faith conquered kingdoms, did what was righteous, obtained the promises. They closed the mouths of lions, put out raging fires, escaped the devouring sword. Out of weakness they were made powerful, became strong in battle, and turned back foreign invaders. Women received back their dead through resurrection. Some were tortured and would not accept deliverance in order to obtain a better resurrection. Others endured mockery, scourging, even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, sawed in two, put to death at a sword's point. They went about in skins of sheep or goats, needy, afflicted, tormented. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered about in deserts and on mountains, in caves and in the crevices of the earth. Yet all these, though approved because of their faith, did not receive what had been promised. God had foreseen something better for us, so that without us they should not be made perfect. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
All this tells me, today's first reading reminds me of what Venerable Sheen said, without Good Friday, there is no Easter Sunday.
Amen.
Life on planet Earth is, as King David says, the valley of the shadow of death. Or what we pray in the Hail Holy Queen. Hail Holy Queen, Mother of Mercy, our life, our sweetness, our hope. It says, to thee do we cry, poor banished children of Eve. To thee do we send up our sighs, mourning and weeping in this valley of tears. Job chapter 7 verse 1 in the Douay Rheim says, life on earth is warfare. Once you understand that, it's easy to understand the saints and the way they were able to enter into the passion of Christ and offer up their sufferings. And their sufferings continue to do a great good, Terry, to the body of Christ today.
Absolutely. Let's bring the smartest guy into the room, Bishop Sheen. Full Sheen ahead. This is a message for mothers right now. Moms who are listening, every mother, when she picks up the young life that has been born to her, looks up to heaven to thank God for the gift which made the world young again. I think of that because I just had a birthday for my grandson yesterday and I had about 25 little kids at my house. And I said to our family and friends, here's the future of the church, all these little kids running around. And I think that's so beautiful because the world says just the opposite. Be selfish, you know, stop having children. You know, we can't afford it. It's going to hurt the ozone layer. Come on, stop it. Well, Bishop Sheen says something else. Jess, let's continue.
Yeah, Terry, I also want to thank Archbishop Samuel Aquila, who made a very powerful statement.
Denver.
Yesterday he said this, quote, let us pray for the conversion of our country.
Yep.
And for the conversion, especially of Catholics who take a so-called pro-choice position. We must pray for their conversion, for the awakening of their consciences, that they may no longer be dead or erroneous, but come to the truth of Jesus Christ. Archbishop Samuel Aquila, that was directed at the current White House administration, Joe Biden and company.
Wow. Jesse, I just have to say, I talked about last week about this vaccine issue, that it's a $69 billion industry. It's more than double than the beer industry. And I'm shocked by it because, you know, we have a saying, follow the money. And so we have an expert with us here, Dr. Alan Moy from the John Paul II Medical Institute. I want to welcome you to our show, doctor.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Good to be here.
Thank you for associating with us. You're in trouble now. You'll get that later, doctor. Yes, let's move on with what we got going here. Go ahead.
Doctor, this is the question that's going to frame the entire discussion.
Yeah.
Can you explain in simple terms to us laymen, laywomen, how people develop immunity to infections?
Yeah, good question.
Sure. So, to develop natural immunity to an infection, there are two stages. The initial stage is called humoral immunity, where we develop antibodies to that infection, typically like a viral infection. That is where we produce antibodies for several weeks to a few months, and those antibodies can wane over time. The second phase is what's called cell-mediated or T-cell immunity. That's where your specific cell called T-cells are turned on. And then you develop this more long-lasting immunity. So, for example, this allows when you are re-exposed to that same virus, you have memory where your body remembers that infection and can combat it. So, as an example, we probably had chickenpox when we were kids.
Yep.
And we got the chickenpox and we had kids. And when your kids got chickenpox, you didn't get chickenpox because you had this T cell immunity that prevented you from getting infected.
A very good answer. Simple. Number two question. Explain, doctor, the rationale for a vaccine, and can you categorize vaccines in a simple terms for lay people?
Sure. So a vaccine is intended to try to mitigate against the severity or of an infection. So ideally, the best way to develop immunity would be to get the natural infection. But for many people, the infection could cause death. It could cause severe infection. So a vaccine is designed to try to mitigate against the severity of an infection. So there are essentially two basic ways in which two different categories of vaccines. One is called the more traditional vaccine methods, which has been around for a century, called whole virus vaccines. This is like your polio vaccine, your smallpox, your routine annual flu vaccines. This is where you grow the virus and cultivate it into a laboratory. And there are two types of vaccines from that. One's called a kill vaccine, where you basically grow the virus, kill it with a chemical, and then that virus is injected into you. That would be your typical shot you get from the flu vaccine every year. The other type of vaccine is called an attenuated live vaccine. So this is a live virus, not a killed virus. But that virus has been cultivated so that it's a transition into a weakened state. So when you're given that vaccine, it's weak enough that won't cause the serious infection, but it has been enough potency to protect you from such an infection. So an example would be the measles vaccine.
Doc, hang on about the measles vaccine. I need you to tell it on the other side of this quick break. I hear the music. You're listening to the Terry and Jesse Show on Virgin Most Powerful Radio. We have Dr. Alan Moy. He's from the John Paul II Medical Institute talking about COVID-19. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Terry and Jesse Show. To join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Now, here's Terry and Jesse.
We're back to Terry and Jesse Show. We're here with Dr. Alan Moy. And Doctor, I know that this is your field of expertise, vaccinations. I just want to ask you a question. As a patient myself, Terry, Barbara, everybody else and stuff that were part of the non-medical community, it's my understanding that patients have the right, based on HIPAA and based on the Patient Privacy Act, that we have the right to refuse vaccination if we go to the doctor. Is that still the case?
That's the case, yes.
Yeah. I just want to make sure.
Well, go ahead, Jesse. Ask the next question.
I just had to get that.
No, that was good to know.
Yeah, I needed to know that because, I went to my doctor. I told him, no, I'm not going to take it. He goes, he didn't ask any questions. He goes, okay, no problem. I was looking at the wall. It said there's a sheet of paper that says Patients right. Privacy Act, and I read it. And so I said, okay, no, thank you, doctor. I'm fine. So what are the pros and cons of whole virus vaccines and subunit vaccines?
Sure. Let me just briefly mention what a subunit vaccine is. A subunit vaccine is something that has been developed more in the last couple of decades. This is instead of giving the whole virus, you're basically expressing a specific viral protein or what we call a viral antigen. And that is the vaccine. And so you develop a antibody response to that viral antigen. And in turn, by developing an antibody response, you are neutralizing, preventing the whole virus from attacking and causing an infection. So the upside and downside of those two different types of vaccine methods, well, in the whole virus method, it's traditional. It's been around for a long time. It can produce immunity pretty rapidly. You only need one injection. It has been pretty good in activating both the humoral antibody immunity and the T cell immunity. The other thing is that it has some cross reactivity against other viral strains. So, for example, those who had SARS back in 2002 have some immunity against COVID. So the downside of a of a whole virus vaccine is that it takes longer to develop. That is why Operation Warp Speed did not want to support whole virus vaccines. Another problem with attenuated live vaccine is there is the risk that that attenuated or weakened virus can revert back to the original wild type virus and cause an infection. So there's some pros and cons with that. Subunit vaccines are quicker to develop. The pharmaceutical companies have off-the-shelf capabilities to large-scale manufacture those vaccines, but they are weaker. That's why you need booster shots. That's why these vaccines, you need another booster a month later. It carries a little bit more risk because your antibody is targeting a specific viral protein. In this case, it's the spike protein. You've all seen pictures where you have the virus with all these little spikes coming out of it. That's the vaccine. So if that spike protein mutates significantly, then the vaccine may not work or may not be effective. The other problem is that those vaccines, subunit vaccines, may not elicit T cell immunity. So you may have no immunity, or you may have a very short-term immunity because you have not established T-cell immunity.
Well, I'm going to school under you, Doc. Wow. Mm. And you also speak a language I can understand. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm getting 3 college units for this interview, Terry.
Next question, Doc. Vaccine development, we heard, takes years to develop. You mentioned this Operation Warp Speed rolled out these vaccinations in an unprecedented time. Now, I, like other people, are concerned about the efficacy and the safety in which these vaccines are rolled out. We hear from the government and medical authorities that these vaccines are effective and safe. Now, question, is the public concern justified?
The public concern, despite what you hear, is very justified.
I hear you. That's what I thought.
So let me tell you how it's done normally.
I'm hearing you.
So when you're developing a vaccine or any type of infectious agent, a therapeutic to an infectious agent, the FDA requires you to go through animal studies. And usually they make you go through two animals to evaluate whether that infectious treatment or anti-infectious treatment is safe and effective against that particular infection. Once you prove that, then you can initiate a clinical trial. In the case of Operation Warp Speed, what the government did is they did those animal studies and the clinical trials in parallel, not sequentially. And so patients were given, for example, the Moderna vaccine, as soon as it was manufactured and tested into patients without actual animal testing. Mm. So because of the speed of and the urgency of this pandemic, they were done in parallel. So the other thing that is of different is the type of vaccines that have been conducted under Operation Warp Speed. They're totally new types of vaccines. These are what's called next-generation gene-based vaccines. So essentially, they're delivering the spike protein gene into your muscle, and your muscle is going to express and produce that spike protein. That type of method has never been approved for any prior infectious disease prior to COVID. Mm. So that's particularly different. And so that method was actually also attempted back when SARS outbreak came out about 2 decades ago. And those vaccines show that it was not sufficient to produce T cell immunity. And so for that reason, those animal studies and those clinical trials were stopped because of a lack of efficacy. And so what's different is that these vaccines are entirely experimental. So it's not an approved vaccine. It's an investigational vaccine.
Sheesh.
Wow. So in the case of Pfizer and Moderna, you're getting a gene, what's called a message RNA or mRNA vaccine. So basic layman's biology is that a gene starts with DNA, transforms into RNA, and then it's made into a protein. So these vaccines are giving you the actual gene, and your body is producing that particular viral protein. This is fundamentally very different than any other traditional approach that the pharmaceutical companies have ever done before. So drugs are, you have to be standardized. They give you a specific dose in a specific formulation. But when they're checking you with a gene, that gene can be well expressed or overexpressed, or it can be underexpressed by a person depending upon that particular person's age or health. And so there's no way to turn on or turn off the production of that protein. So for younger people or healthy young, it's going to be a lot easier for that patient to express that protein. That's the good thing. But on the flip side, there is less control of in trying to shut that off. Okay, so in a younger person, healthy person, there is the risk that there could be adverse effects, health effects, because you have not been able to shut that gene from being expressed. Now, in the flip side, if you have elderly patients, the older you are, the sicker you are, it's going to be more difficult to express that particular gene protein product. But on the good side, because of that, it will be easier to shut that protein down. So there will be probably a lesser adverse effect because it's easier to shut off. So lack of standardization is a major problem with these types of treatments.
Wow. That's all I can say. Jess?
Doctor, does your John Paul II Institute, do you guys have any effect on the conversation with, you know, the CDC, the World Health Organization, kind of the movers and shakers behind this? Obviously, you come from a Catholic worldview, and so do you guys have a voice at the table with those people that are in charge of all this?
So that's an interesting question. So one of the things that came up with Operation Warp Speed was there was criticism among leading virologists that Operation Warp Speed was not devoting resources towards traditional vaccine methods. And the reason was that, as I said earlier, traditional vaccine methods like attenuated live vaccines, which is the gold standard, they felt would take too long to develop because they wanted to rush and get this vaccine out, obviously for political reasons, right? Mm-hmm. And so we had a conversation, our institute had a conversation with the leading individuals that were running Operation Warp Speed, and we raised this concerns that you don't have backup strategies with traditional vaccine methods. And the answer they gave us was, well, unless it was going to be developed within and get into a clinical trial within 3 to 6 months, we were not going to support it.
Wow, that's scary. I'm just saying, that's scary, Doc. Wow.
Well, it is scary because that's the problem we now face, is that we do not have sufficient research in developing an attenuated live vaccine, which would have broader coverage for new strains that would evolve once the Wuhan strain was introduced. Now we have strains from the United Kingdom, we have strains from South Africa, and we have strains from Brazil that have mutations.
Yeah.
And those mutations are going to have different effectiveness against the vaccines and other types of therapies.
Doctor, when we come back from the break, that's the question I want to ask you about the effectiveness of these vaccines, because we hear, that 90%, effectiveness. Is that true, and why is it, or why is it not? You're listening to the Terry and Jesse Show on Virgin Most Powerful Radio. We have Dr. Alan Moy from the John Paul II Medical Institute talking about COVID-19 vaccines and the pandemic. Don't turn that dial. You're getting an education like we are. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Terry and Jesse Show. To join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Now, here's Terry and Jesse.
We've got Dr. Ellen Moy on right now, and he's giving us a real school. He's taking us to school on the entire question about the, the viruses, the vaccine, the infections. And Dr. Ellen is from the John Paul II Medical Institute. I'm so glad that this institute exists. At least we Catholics have a voice on the table. So, Doctor, we hear from the news, we hear from government and medical experts that these genetic-based vaccines like Pfizer and Moderna, they've achieved over 90% effectiveness. That seems extraordinary. How true is that?
Well, it's true depending upon how you want to define success.
Okay.
So let me start out by giving you an analogy. Let's say that I have two cars. I have a brand new car and I have a 15-year-old car that has 150,000 miles and breaks down every other month. And I want to prove to you the second car is good. So I say, as a benchmark of success, I'm going to show that I'm going to define success that my car can drive down to the corner drugstore. So yes, it probably can. But if I move the goalposts and said, can that second car drive across the country without breaking down? Well, that would probably be a different story. So what the pharmaceutical companies do is they go to the FDA and they say, you have to tell us, FDA, how you're going to define success. And so what they do is they create a vaccine group and a placebo group. And they give the vaccine and they say, within 2 months, we're going to see how many patients develop, how many patients get COVID. And so within that 2 month window, after they've been vaccinated, there was over a 90% reduction in the number of new cases of COVID. Well, one would expect that would occur because these vaccines are going to produce antibodies within that time window. And so you would expect within that specific time window, it would work. The problem is that the antibody levels will, if you're between the ages of 55 to 70, by 3 months, they will decline by 50%. And if you're over the age of 70, they're going to decline by 70%. So we don't know how long that immune protection will last. Will they be protected by 4 months after you've been vaccinated? 6 months? We don't know. But based on the clinical data, it is very possible that if you're over 70 and you have some chronic diseases, which a lot of patients over the age of 70 will have, that they may not be any more protected by that time than if they were not vaccinated at all. And so what you have here is a condition in which the medical justification for vaccine mandates doesn't make good medical science sense. And it will give a false sense of security that people are protected. That's the underlying problem.
Thank you for saying that, Doc, because I suspected all of that from what I'm reading as a layman. So it's nice to hear it right from the doctor's mouth. Doc, here's another question. We hear from the news, the government, medical experts on the news, that these genetic-based vaccines are safe. Yet we hear anecdotal reports about individuals dying after taking the vaccines and serious complications arise. How safe are they, and are they any uniquely safety issues that the public should be aware of with COVID-19 vaccines? And I bring this up, Doc, because I just was with my relative who's a fireman in L.A. City, and he took both shots, and the second shot put him down for several days. He was so sick. And so my question to you is, are these really safe?
So I think the safety is not well defined. Not well defined. So I think the CDC, the FDA, the medical elitists will say they're safe because they have acceptable risks. But they're here. I want to give you some read you some facts about comparing the safety profile of these of those two vaccines with your annual flu vaccine, which you're probably used to. So there are two different types of categories of adverse reactions with vaccines. One is your local reaction. You might get a little arm pain. You may get a little redness, swelling. Well, the influenza vaccine incidence is very comparable to Pfizer and Moderna. No problem there. But if you look at systemic reactions, those are when your immune system overreacts to a vaccine, like chills, fever, headaches, body aches, muscle aches, arthralgias. So let me read you. For influenza, the incidence of fatigue is less than 22%. For Pfizer, it's between 34 to 59. Moderna, 60 to 65%. Headache, 1 to 27% for flu, 25 to 52 for Pfizer, 60% for Moderna. Bone aches, joint aches, 4 to 15% for influenza, 9 to 22% for Pfizer, 35 to 40% for Moderna. Muscle aches, 5 to 40 for influenza, similar for Pfizer, 50% for Moderna. Fever, less than 4% for influenza, 1 to 16% for Pfizer, 55% for Moderna. Chills, less than 9% for influenza, Pfizer 6 to 35, and Moderna 40%. So for these systemic reactions, there is roughly between 50 to 400% increase in systemic reactions compared to the flu vaccine. So that's one level. There is all there is also another potentially very serious reaction, one of which is when you look at some of the vaccine data from the SARS outbreak. In the SARS outbreak, there were situations where the animals were given the vaccines and they were then given the SARS wild-type virus. In some of those animal models, the vaccinated animals actually had worse lung and liver injury than the unvaccinated animals. And when they looked at the type of the explanation why, there was a specific type of immune response, inflammatory response. Well, that particular inflammatory response in those animals is the same immune response that occurs in some patients with allergic rhinitis and asthma. Okay, now as a pulmonologist who takes care of lung patients, who takes care of patients with asthma, I have patients who already have heightened levels of that type of immunity. And so I cannot tell from the data that's been published whether those patients are going to be increased risk for developing a more severe case of COVID than if they were not vaccinated at all. And so the problem is that in these animal studies under Operation Warp Speed, there was not sufficient animal data in specific models like in asthma or in other specific disease states where I can confidently say that those my patients will not have an adverse reaction. The other problem is that in these clinical trials, 80% of the patients were healthy, and only 20% of the patients were actually had a chronic disease. So only 5% of the patients had, say, COPD. And I have a lot of patients with COPD who are over the age of 50, and I cannot tell because the sample sizes are too small whether I can predict from these clinical trials how my patients are going to respond.
Wow.
Dr. Alan Moy, I want to get into a Catholic question here. I'm going to insert a moral question with your medical expertise and your Catholic faith as well. The COVID-19 vaccine has created a moral controversy amongst Catholics across the country. In fact, the 2005 Pontifical Council for Life stated that if an infectious disease was grave and if a morally licit vaccine was not available, then it was morally permissible for a Catholic to accept the vaccine or medicine that was derived or used with a morally illicit cell derived from an abortion. We hear that aborted fetal cells, specifically one called the HEK-293 cell line, they were used in some fashion in the vaccine design or in the testing or in the manufacturing. So I have a two-part question for you. Number one, are there any Operation Warp Speed vaccines that did not use aborted fetal cells? And number two, are there any alternative vaccines or treatments to deal with COVID-19 that are free of any ethical controversy for people of faith?
Doctor, before you answer that question, we got to take a quick break. This is what we call a cliffhanger, because this is a really critical question to answer. And we're going to be following up with more regarding our Catholic faith and COVID-19 here on Virgin Most Powerful Radio. I want to remind people the Spiritual Warfare Conference that we did 2 weeks ago is still available for people who want to pick up those audio recordings. You just go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org, or you can call the guys here at 877-526-215. We come back, Dr. Alan Moy from the John Paul II Medical Institute will continue to educate us on the risks factoring COVID-19, the vaccines, and the pandemic. This is an education. I want to encourage you to listen to it on the podcast over again. I sure will. We'll be right back with more on the Terry and Jesse Show.
Welcome back to the Terry and Jesse Show. To join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Now, here's Terry and Jesse.
The Terry and Jesse Show. If you like what you hear, then like us and hit the subscribe button and hit the bell to be notified and share this show with others. If you like what you hear, we've got Dr. Alan Moy from the John Paul Institute. He's taking some tough questions, but these are the questions that Catholics want to know. Let me repeat my question for those that are just tuning in right now. So, Dr. Allen, the COVID-19 vaccine has created a moral controversy amongst Catholics, and the 2005 Pontifical Council for Life, they stated that if an infectious disease was grave and if a morally licit vaccine was not available, then it's permissible, morally permissible for a Catholic to accept the vaccine or medicine that was derived or used with a morally illicit cell derived from an abortion. We hear that aborted fetal cells, specifically one called the HEK-293 cell line, were used in some fashion in some vaccine design or testing or manufacturing. So my two-part question is, number one, are there any Operation Warp Speed vaccines that did not use aborted fetal cells? And number two, are there any alternative vaccines or treatments to deal with COVID-19 that are free of ethical controversy?
So unfortunately, there were eight to my knowledge, 8 Operation Warp Speed vaccines, and only one of them, which is through manufactured for Sanofi, which is still in clinical trial. We don't have enough information on whether they used the AGK-293 in their testing phase. But all of the other, and Merck actually got out of the vaccine race. But the remaining ones, all of them are using the AGK-293 to some extent, some worse than others. So Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca are using an aborted fetal cell line like the 293 in the manufacturing. And the remaining are using the 293 in the testing phase. So there are what they call relative moral illicit vaccines here. To the second part of your question, and just to add that the 293 is ubiquitous in medical research. It's used in everything. It's used, if you're a cystic fibrosis patient, you have a drug that's using the 293. If you're hemophiliac, you're using the 293. If you need gene therapy, you're using the 293. If you're doing any kind of viral work, if you're a medical researcher doing any type of viral work, most likely you're using the 293. So it's an everywhere. To your second part of the question, there are treatments that are not vaccines that are available for patients who are high risk. And this is the controversial hydroxychloroquine that people were complaining because President Trump had mentioned it. Yeah. So what some scientists and experts say, well, hydroxychloroquine doesn't work, or it is unsafe. It causes cardiac arrhythmias. Well, the truth of the matter is hydroxychloroquine is not going to be effective if you have a severe enough COVID infection and you're in the hospital. At that point, it won't work. Second is that where it works is in the early stages. In the ambulatory setting, if you have a high-risk patient, like someone who's elderly, over 65, or with comorbidities, hypertension, lung disease, heart disease, diabetes, or obesity, if it is administered early enough, within 7 days of the onset of symptoms, it will have a pretty good track record of reducing the morbidity, mortality, reducing the risk of hospitalization, and reducing viral transmission. And that is also true with another drug called ivermectin, which is used for treating parasites. So these two drugs in combination with zinc and antibiotics, either azithromycin or doxycycline, have shown in high-risk patients given early can reduce hospitalization, mortality, and viral transmission. So in that situation, there's actually a treatment that you can take if you are in that high-risk group. Unfortunately, hydroxychloroquine is only administered by 20% of practicing physicians. It's available in many states, but not in states that are typically blue political states. And so what you probably have to do, should do, is that if you're one of those high-risk patients, you should have a conversation with your doctor and ask them, if you come down with COVID, will he or she prescribe that drug cocktail or not?
Great question. Here's my next question. I know we're running out of time, but so much. Doctor, many in the Catholic hierarchy are urging everyone to get vaccinated based on the argument, I hear it all the time, that it's necessary to prevent the viral transmission to vulnerable groups like the elderly. The arguments are being couched in terms of compassion and moral duty and charity. But from a scientific perspective, is there a scientific basis that the vaccine will prevent viral transmission? And is this argument justified? Big question.
So that argument is plain erroneous. These vaccines do not prevent viral transmission. Vaccines only work by reducing the severity of the viral illness in the person who gets vaccinated. So it is fallacious for anyone to say it is the duty for young people to take the vaccine just to protect the elderly and those with chronic disease or high risk. I would not want to see my children or anyone else's children or grandchildren have to be vaccinated and be put at risk just because to try to protect me when that won't happen anyway.
Thank you.
Doctor, so we hear that there are new viral strains coming from the UK, Brazil, and South Africa, excuse me. Will the current vaccines and the standard of care be effective as a strain that originated from Wuhan, China? What are your thoughts?
So we don't have a lot of peer review research to be able to answer that. What we only have right now is the press releases from these companies. Mm-hmm. And what we're hearing right now is that the current Wuhan vaccine has some effectiveness against the UK strain, but it may not be as good or effective against the South African strain, and we don't have any information about Brazil. And this is a problem with these vaccine methods that are based on what I call the subunit approach that is specifically targeting the spike protein, because the spike protein is constantly mutating and it's basically trying to, you know, try to chasing your tail all the time. Mm-hmm. Is that you're trying to keep up as the spike protein is mutating in real time.
Doctor, we only have a couple minutes left, but I want to make sure people can go to a website, and I hope to have you back on a regular basis myself. Hey, question. We want to know that your institute is, you know, we know that you're working on a vaccine or a treatment for the COVID-19, but for our audience, can you provide an assurance that your research program is not using the HEK293 cell line that we hear so much about that was derived from aborted fetuses in the 1970s? I want to hear the right... Don't give me any political answer. I want to know, are you doing it or not?
No, we're not.
Good.
So our cell line, we've made a specialized cell line that is derived from a stem cell from cord blood. And essentially, we have been able to in-house develop this technology in-house. It will be free of aborted fetal cells, both in design, manufacturing, and testing.
Awesome. Yes.
So in simple terms, can you explain how your research program differentiates scientifically from the Operation Warp Speed, and at what stage is your vaccine in development, and when do you anticipate it's going to be ready for clinical use or clinical testing?
So our vaccines are still in preclinical development. So this is the frequently asked question we get, because people are concerned, Catholics are concerned about taking these current vaccines, because they have been tainted with the 293 cell line. And so we tell them, people, that it's not ready for prime time. We still have to do, it's still in preclinical development, and it would be at best case a year and a half before this could be available for clinical trials. Now, that said, that sounds long time from now, but the reality is the pharmaceutical companies, along with the government, they are predicting that these vaccines and the need for ongoing COVID-19 vaccines are going to continue in the future. So this issue, both scientifically and morally, is not going to go away. So what's different about our approach is that, number one, we are making a attenuated live vaccine. So we think that is a better approach, a more traditional approach. And the other is we are making a subunit approach, but it is not based and restricted to just relying on the spike protein. So those are two different innovations that are not been part of Operation Warp Speed.
Doc, I just want to say this because we got to end. We are glad to partner with you and the John Paul II Medical Institute to expose the truth about COVID-19. And Jess, are you with me, brother? We'd love to have him back, man.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's going to be very relevant.
Yeah, giving us updates. Yeah.
Yep.
Sure. I appreciate you let me opportunity to speak.
Are you kidding me? We're happy that you're willing to take it on the chin for Jesus. That's what I say, because this truth is what sets us free in all aspects of our life. Thanks again from the Dr. Alan Moy from the John Paul II Medical Institute. Listen to this, Doc. This is how we end every show. You'll remember. Jess, what state should we be living in, brother?
Live in a state of grace. Don't live in a state of mortal sin. And remember, life is short. Eternity's forever. Terry, take it away.
God bless you. Dr. Alan Moy from the John Paul II Medical Institute. We'll have you on again and again to keep us informed on this important topic. I want to ask everybody to continue to pray for the John Paul II Medical Institute, because they've got big work ahead of them and they need your prayers as we need your prayers also. May God richly bless all of our listeners, and take this out. Get this word out on social media. God love you.